Where once people talked about homing in on a solution to a problem, now many people speak of honing in with an N. Language does change over time, but there is a correct way to say something, right? Our next guest certainly thinks so. He's filled a book with some refinements to the way we speak. Real subtle differences like pliable versus pliant. The book is called How to Tell Fate from Destiny and Other Skillful Word Distinctions. It is the work of Charles Harrington Elster, who is the author of 11 previous books on the English language and its use and misuse, including the titles What in the Word? And The Big Book of Beastly Mispronunciations. The works are generally aimed at a general audience. Charles Harrington Elster, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
How did this become your life's work?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I generally answer that, though, by saying that I'm the product of two professional musicians who had a love for language. And I, although I'm sort of an amateur musician, I wound up becoming a wordsmith or a language maven to make my living, and music is my hobby, whereas they were professional musicians who instilled in me a love of language.
All right, so you provide some good appetizers to the main course right at the introduction to the book, and based on what we were talking about in our introduction, it is home in with an M, right?
Yes, it is properly home in. Yeah, you can hone your skills, but think of a homing pigeon when you are trying to zero in on a target or a goal. You're homing in on that target.
All right, so you can hone something, but you don't hone in.
That's right. That's right. It's kind. There are a lot of slightly different variations with some of these expressions. People change a vowel or a sound in the middle of the word. They say, my old stomping grounds. But the original expression is my old stamping grounds, because the quadrupeds, the horses or whatever, would gather there, the cattle, and they would stamp around as they herded. But we forgot that, and we just thought of the stamping part, and we changed it to stomping. So this happens all the time. I mean, there are examples from Shakespeare. These aren't part of this particular book, but we misquote Shakespeare all the time. We say, all that glistens is not gold, and Shakespeare actually wrote, all that glisters is not gold. So this happens over time, and this book attempts to correct a few of those misconceptions. But in the case of something like stamping and stomping grounds, I don't have any great hopes that most of us will start saying it right as stamping instead of stomping. You know, sometimes when enough of us are wrong, we're right, as William Safire used to say.
Well, which raises the question, I mean, whether you sometimes feel like you're trying to hold back the tide or something here. I mean, as more and more people say things like, I'm going to hone in on that. I mean, if you just feel like you're fighting a bit of a rear guard action.
Well, I may be jumping the gun a little bit, Jeffrey, but in my explanation about what's the difference between fate and destiny, which is the title of the book, How to Tell Fate from Destiny, I like to say, even this was an afterthought, it didn't get into the book, but I like to say that I'm like, and fate is like, Sisyphus. I'm pushing the rock up the hill. That's my fate. And my destiny is when I get to the top, or almost to the top, my destiny is to watch it roll back down, and all my efforts are for naught. So that's why I have to keep writing more books, because people aren't getting the message, and I still need to broadcast it. No, actually, I have lots of wonderful readers and fans who correspond with me, and I love it. Please visit my website, charlesharringtonelster.com. I'd love to correspond with you and answer your questions. But it's still, you're right, it's an uphill battle. It's often a losing battle. You mentioned my big book of beastly mispronunciations, kind of my magnum opus. I'm perhaps best known for being a pronunciation maven or expert, or, you know, if you want the fancy word for it, an orthoepist, a person who promotes correct pronunciation. And so many of those words that I write about, you know, will never, I'll never be able to turn back the tide. But I'm going to make my statement, and I'm going to inform people that, look, this is the way it was, this is the way it is. You know, I'm sort of an observer as well as a prescriber. And I'll give you just one example of a lost cause. People say minuscule now. But may I put you on the spot just for a moment here?
Sure.
Would you spell that word for me?
M-I-N-I-S-C-U-L-E, minuscule.
Okay. Well, see, that spelling, M-I-N-I, is in fact the spurious spelling.
Oops.
It is the variant spelling. And the word is properly spelled M-I-N-U-S-C-U-L-E because it comes from the Latin minus, minus in English, which means less. So the traditional pronunciation, you're probably going, your jaw's going to drop, is minuscule. And that's the way I say it, just to make a point. And the corresponding word, which nobody uses and therefore nobody mispronounces, is majuscule. And that refers to a way of writing in capital letters, majuscule, or in small or lowercase letters, minuscule. But everybody says minuscule because they think it means tiny, and mini is supposed to mean small, M-I-N-I. And then they start spelling it M-I-N-I. So this is how language changes, largely through misconception.
All right. Much more to talk about with Charles Harrington Elster about his book, How to Tell Fate from Destiny and Other Skillful Word Distinctions, many that may drive you up the wall. Share them with us by phone and email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about language here on the program today, about some rather subtle differences between words: stamping grounds, stomping grounds, home in, hone in, imitate, emulate, pliable, pliant, and supple. These are all things that Charles Harrington Elster can find the differences between, and he put them in his book, How to Tell Fate from Destiny and Other Skillful Word Distinctions. I'm already down 1 point because I spelled minuscule wrong. You can join the conversation with us and help us clear up a few other things about language as we go through. 800-838-3760 to come in by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So to the subtlety of the differences, we just minuscule and minuscule, I mean, spelled a couple of different ways. Stamping and stomping, the difference of one letter again. Imitate and emulate, and I've actually been tossing this one around in my head. I'm trying to figure out what the difference is between them.
It's a tough one, but here's the mnemonic for you. Imitate is to copy. Emulate is to strive to equal or excel. So you might want to imitate someone's mannerisms, imitate their way of talking. You could be doing this because you admire that person or because you want to make fun of that person. But when you emulate, you are always in a kind of competition. You are always trying to be as good as or better.
Okay, so imitate is just basically the carbon copy. If you're actually trying to start from where they are and then get better than that, that's emulation.
Right, right. So the pupil might want to emulate the master, not imitate.
Makes sense.
But you might want to imitate, say someone studying how to be a chef might want to imitate the knife, the technique of a Jacques Pepin. Yeah, and you have to imitate too before you can emulate. You know?
Yeah, so at one point it does turn into the other thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, in a way it does. Yeah. It's not like for instance, immigrate and emigrate, which the prefixes should tell you clearly the direction you're going. Im is just like IM is just, as a prefix is just like IN. It changes to an M before an M, a B, or a P for ease of pronunciation. But in, you know, immigrate, it's really in, which is in or into, and emigrate, that's short for, the E is short for X, which means out. So immigrate, you're coming in, you immigrate to, and emigrate, you're going out, so you emigrate from.
I must admit that the more I got into the book and saw just how subtle some of these differences are, I felt a little untethered, like I'd left the shore behind, you know, finding that I not only couldn't understand necessarily the differences between the words, I wasn't sure I'd even heard one of them. An example, I've heard the word perspicacious, but I began to doubt my own thoughts about what it meant when I saw that you put perspicuous right next to it.
Well, sometimes I like to challenge people.
It works.
Yeah. Those are two great words, and a lot of educated people who have come across them in reading and so forth and may even be using them, mostly in writing, of course, will confuse them because of their similar sound. Mm-hmm. But if you learn more about words, there's always something to learn about words, and I always tell people, don't read around words you don't know. Look them up in a dictionary, because if you guess what a word means from context, and that's all you do, you don't verify your guess, well, you might be guessing wrong. You might be building a vocabulary filled with incorrect definitions. I'll give you one very quick example. I have two books that are vocabulary-building novels for high school students. Mm-hmm. The first one was Tooth and Nail, and the second, Test of Time. And they are designed to teach the vocabulary that young people need, high school students need to know to take the SAT and the ACT, the college entrance exams. And essentially the concept is you read a novel in which these SAT, ACT words are incorporated, printed in boldface, so you know those are test words, and then they are defined in a glossary in the back. So one time I was talking about the first of these books, Tooth and Nail, and a parent came up to me and she said, well, I can just figure out the word from context. And I said, really? And I put her on the spot the way I just did to you, I'm sorry, a moment ago. Right. And I said, really? Let me give you a sample sentence. After her exciting night on the town, she felt enervated. And this is also leading to a distinction that's in my new book, How to Tell Fate from Destiny. I said, what does enervated mean in that sentence? After her exciting night on the town, she felt enervated. And I knew that this parent would say, oh, she was stimulated. She was excited. She was energized. Uh-huh. And I said, bingo, I got you, because it's a sound-alike confusion. Enervate, if you break it down, if you look in the dictionary and you don't just check definitions, but you check pronunciation and you check etymology, the origin of the word, it's all in the entry, you'll discover that enervate means to be without energy, to have your nerves essentially taken away. And energize is the opposite. It's to be full of energy.
So if you're enervated after a night in the town, you're drained?
Well, that's why I told her that context can be ambiguous, so you can't rely only on the context and guessing from it. You have to check your guess in a dictionary or in one of my books. it can be a very confusing thing, and you look at perspicuous and perspicacious, and they're almost spelled alike. They sound somewhat similar. You know, and you have no idea, unless you know a little more about the words, unless you check them in a dictionary, you will not know that one has to do with your mind and the other with clarity or vision or lucidity. So perspicuous is the one that means clear, perspicuous prose. And perspicacious is the one that has to do with how you use your brain, how you reason, how well you understand.
So if you have a perspicacious mind, you would have understood the use of enervate in that sentence, but the sentence was not being perspicuous, therefore we couldn't understand what enervate meant?
That's very good, Jeffrey. That is very good. Yeah, I like that.
I'm sweating. We're talking to Charles Harrington Elster here on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is called How to Tell Fate from Destiny and Other Skillful Word Distinctions. You ask a great question in the book, Charles. Who decides how or how not to make these distinctions? And what is the answer to that question?
Well, let me preface my answer to that question with this comment. I call myself a language maven. I'm not a linguist. I'm a professional lover of the language and writer about the language for a general audience. I write popular reference books about English. I am also known as a prescriptivist because, as a writer of such books, and a commentator on the radio, I say this is right and that's wrong, or things are changing or whatever. I have an opinion and I express it. A linguist is a so-called scientist of language, and the linguists, also known as descriptivists when they make dictionaries, purportedly do not pass judgment on words or language or usage. They simply observe and describe. It's supposedly they're looking in a mirror and showing you the reflection, or putting language up to a mirror and showing you the reflection. I don't really buy that, but there's been this long-standing debate between these two camps. Those of us who are professional word users, writers and speakers, really want to get it right, or really don't want to be embarrassed in front of an audience. And then the ivory tower types who say, well, language is language and whatever you do is correct, essentially, because that's the nature of the process. Okay, that said, in my introduction, I talk about who makes these decisions. Well, it is true. We all do. We all do, and as I mentioned before, often change comes about because of misconception. And again, whenever enough of us get the wrong idea, you know, whenever enough of us are wrong, we're right. But it's okay to do what I do, and I call people who think the way I do, you know, cultivated users of the language, or conscientious users, or careful speakers and writers, because more thought is put into it, more study is put into it, more concern is given it. It's not just, oh, whatever the last person I heard whom I respect happened to say, I'll do it that way. You see what I'm getting at? Inform yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's why I write these books. Inform yourself, get some information, then make up your own mind. And that's how we change the language. Or we should change the language, you know, communally in an informed, hey, this is election day, Jeffrey, right?
Right.
So presumably you've read your ballot, you've studied the issues, you've paid some attention on TV and radio, you've maybe heard the candidate speak and so forth, and you've analyzed, to some extent anyway, the propositions on your ballot. And then you go and you cast your vote, you express your opinion. That's the way language should work. But instead, it kind of works like we got our ballot when we were born and we never looked at it, and we're just going along and taking whatever's thrown at us.
Ah, so a little more examination is called for here, for sure. I wanted to ask you, Charles, because you used the word supposedly in passing, if the pronunciation as supposedly ended up in the big book of beastly mispronunciations.
You know, I can't remember whether it's in my second edition. Hold on. It's right here, or whether it's slated for the third edition, which I'm still trying to sell.
Because that's what I find cringeworthy myself.
Oh, it's very cringeworthy, and I would just call it beastly. And yes, it's in here. It's in my second edition of the Big Book of Beastly Mispronunciation. Supposedly is proper, of course, and mispronounced supposedly by the careless and supposedly by the semi-literate. That's what I said about it.
Okay. Charles Harrington Elster.
I can be a little snarky.
I noticed. Charles Harrington Elster, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange's book is How to Tell Fate from Destiny and Other Skillful Word Distinctions. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We are waiving the one call per week rule this week because there's a lot to talk about this week. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Call from Jamie in Medford on line one. Welcome to the Exchange.
Morning, Jeffrey. Morning, Charles. Well, etymology is my favorite hobby because it's free and it's fun. And Charles, I have a couple of questions for you.
Go ahead.
Well, there's there's two terms. One is on the table versus tabling it. And the word people misuse, I believe, to two words is flammable versus inflammable. And Jeffrey, I'll take my answer
off the radio. Okay, thanks for that, Jamie. Good to hear from you. So those are good choices: on the table versus tabling something, and flammable and inflammable.
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure where the distinction is with the first one about table, something is on the table, or, I mean, on the table.
Well, if you put something on the table, like laying your cards on the table, you're presenting your case or your argument versus putting something.
Tabling it, you're putting it aside.
Right.
Right. Well, it's just an example of the way we take really simple words. Look up the word set in your dictionary, and you'll see, if you have a large enough dictionary, probably over 100 definitions for a three-letter word. So that's what we do in English, and that's why English is the most has the most voluminous and gargantuan vocabulary of any language on earth. Flammable and inflammable, that's in How to Tell Fate from Destiny, because that's a classic confusable, as we call them. And I wrote that the burning question here is, what's the proper word to use when the meaning is not capable of burning? Should it be inflammable or non-flammable? Because flammable, we all know, means capable of burning, uh-huh. right? So what's the opposite? Is it inflammable or non-flammable? And both opposites of flammable, but which one is better and which one is dominant? And I conclude that inflammable is not the better choice, because it could be construed, and has been in the past, as merely an intensive of flammable, or simply a synonym. Mm-hmm. Whereas non-flammable, with that clear non, meaning not, in the beginning, better opposite of flammable.
Well, I'm glad Jamie brought that up, because I always wondered particularly about the flammable, inflammable thing, because I do remember reading product labels that warned you, don't get matches near this because it's highly inflammable. And of course, at 8 years old, I'm thinking, if it's inflammable, it won't burn, right?
Well, you had a developed sense of prefixes at 8 years old, but you're right.
All right. So another question here, this one from, looks like Joy's in Talent. She says two questions here. What's the difference between ensure and insure? And do you believe that people care less now about language than they did 50 years ago?
I'll answer the second question first with a simple, no, I don't. Not that my book sales are through the roof, but there are enough people out there who love to, as the poet John Chardy once said, engage the instrument of the language. And that's all I'm asking people to do. Just come with me and play in that orchestra. Play mindfully in that orchestra. It's not that people care less, I think, as much as... It might be a couple of subtle things. One, depending on our age, you know, if we're older, we've seen more changes. That's just true of life, reality. You're going to see more changes in the world. You're going to see more changes in language. But I think also there are just more people out there, and English is the most popular language on earth in the last 100 years or so. It has become way far the dominant language on earth. It's become... It's replaced French as the language of diplomacy. It's the language of aviation, you know, business conferences, and so on and so forth. So there are just more people speaking English. In fact, more people speak English as a second language in the world. Actually, just in China, more people speak English as a second language than there are native speakers in the United States. So, you know, I'm not saying that second language speakers are the ones who are changing things necessarily, or, you know, making them all the mistakes. Far from it. Native speakers have a lot of work to do, but there are just more people speaking English and writing English, so more changes are going to happen, more mistakes are going to be made. Remind me of the first question now, please.
It was the ensure, insure, and in a usage like, you know, how can we ensure that this won't happen again, or do we ensure that it won't happen again?
Yeah, it's a great question. I fully discussed in How to Tell Fate from Destiny, and the short answer is I advocate the EN sure and the IN sure are constantly confounded. They're all switched up and so on and so forth. And the British have their way of doing it, which is usually with the IN. In America, don't pay attention to those people across the pond. In America, we need to settle on a distinction that we've been trying to make for a long time, simply that When you ensure with an EN, you guarantee. When you insure with an IN, you're paying somebody to, you know, against risk or loss on your house or your car or so forth. That's the simple way to do it. You ensure for all basic figurative uses and insure for insurance usage.
All right, so the dollars are where we get to the insure part. We're talking to Charles Harrington Elster about his book, How to Tell Fate from Destiny and Other Skillful Word Distinctions. All kinds of fun stuff coming up in our final segment. You can join us by phone and email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. We are talking about language with Charles Harrington Elster, who's now written a dozen books about language and its use and often its misuse. One of his earlier books is The Big Book of Beastly Mispronunciations, about to go into a third edition. We're talking about his latest book, which is How to Tell Fate from Destiny and Other Skillful Word Distinctions. And it is just about word distinctions, not fate or destiny in a philosophical or religious sense, just about what those words mean and how they are different from each other. Like, how is home in different from hone in? Home in is correct. Follow the pigeons. Join us on the exchange with issues from your own use of language and what you've noticed from people doing around you. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go to a phone call here from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Charles Harrington Elster.
Thanks. Interesting topic. Okay, how about data versus data, route or route? And here's a good one. The British, we call it a schedule, and the British call it a, how do they say it?
Schedule.
Schedule.
Mm-hmm. Schedule. That out. Any take on that one? So thanks.
All right, thank you, John.
Yeah, the British are strange, and a lot of the things that I say in my big book of beastly mispronunciations are pot shots across the pond, because they've taken pot shots at us for as long as we've been around as a country. They used to make fun of Thomas Jefferson because he used the word belittle, and they thought that was very silly.
Oh, right.
So there are clear differences in words like schedule and, say, lieutenant versus lieutenant, that kind of thing. The Brits also say something which, for an American speaker, is a completely beastly mispronunciation. They say jewelry, and they even spell it with two L's.
Really?
And at the end, they spell it, W-E-L-L-E-R-Y, jewelry. And that's the way they say it. But if we say jewelry or jewelry, which is a metathesis, that's a beastly mispronunciation. We need to say jewelry, jewelry.
I've also noticed they don't pronounce the middle I in medicine. They call people who practice, people who are doctors, they practice medicine.
Right. They'll clip some. Well, there's so many accusations both ways across the pond. We Americans are too nasal for the Brits. Mm-hmm. The Brits are too clipped for the Americans. They anything that ends in O-R-Y, they pronounce tree. They say, instead of transitory, an American would say, they say transitory.
Uh-huh.
That kind of thing, you know. So back to the route and the route. That's kind of a toss-up. You can sort of go, I think, with what you learned and what you're accustomed to and what the people around you are using. Although sometimes there's a distinction between sort of a course that, say a mail carrier or a delivery person would go on. It tends to be a little more route, but route is the more traditional pronunciation, kind of taking its cue from the original French. And that's the one I use in almost every context. It's kind of like harass and harass. They're both about the same age, and they both have vied for preeminence for a long time. So it's really still a bit of a toss-up. And the first one was, again, please?
Data or data. This is one I struggle with. I've pronounced it different ways in the same broadcast.
That's a very common thing, especially if maybe there's there's somebody else who's saying it a certain way, and you don't want to offend them by saying it your way, so you do it their way as a gesture of conversation, conciliation, whatever. So here's an interesting thing. You know, when a word of two syllables taken directly from Latin, as this one is, has a long syllable in the original Latin, in the first syllable. Technically speaking, English has said that Latin loanword needs to have a long vowel sound in that first stressed syllable. So I would advocate for data as the traditional pronunciation. But some of these words do actually have their syllables closed after the consonant following the vowel. I hope I'm not being too technical here. So, you know, if the word is divided D-A-T hyphen A, which it's not, but if it were, data would be a legitimate pronunciation, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's see. We have an email here from Mary, no town given. She says the word for as long as I can remember was pronounced. She's talking about the word often. Or is soften? She said, I've heard more TV and radio announcers say often with the T accent. She wants to know why it happened. She heard that in England it's always been with the T sounded, but not here. She taught elementary school for years, and it was one of her special spelling words that we taught. She says, thanks for pronouncing it with a silent T. That's from Mary.
Well, you're welcome, Mary. I will never pronounce the T in often. It's important to me to keep it silent. I have a lengthy article explaining and answering, I think, most of those questions in my big book of beastly mispronunciations. The short answer, the radio answer, of course, is that the T was once sounded in English speech. Not necessarily any longer, although more and more British speakers are sounding the T, as are many more American speakers in recent years. But the T was sounded as it sometimes was in similar words like soften and glisten and chasten and hasten and so forth. But that faded by the time that John Walker published his landmark pronunciation dictionary in the late 1700s. And Walker was very influential in England and in America, and that T was silent from then on. And it started to reinsert itself in the speech of the young, the under 30 set, in the late 20th century. And that grew to such an extent that older speakers started to pick it up. It's kind of like what happened with the word controversial.
Mm-hmm.
If you went back to my youth in the 1960s, never have heard anybody say controversial. But starting in the 80s and 90s, controversial, which may have been a British import, started to take America by storm. And now you can hear people like, I don't know if he actually says this, but you can hear somebody of the stature of a Tom Brokaw say, you know, controversial. And nobody bats an eyelash. And I just think those are a little pretentious. You know, it's like saying negotiate instead of negotiate. Why do we make these changes? I think we have a restless ambition always for innovation. We just get tired with the old, and we're always reaching for the new. And that's not only in pronunciation, but also in vocabulary. We don't say, oh, I'm reluctant to answer that question anymore. We say, I'm reticent to answer that question, or I'm reticent to talk. This is a terrible mistake, simply because people are reaching for a fancier word because they're tired of the ordinary word. But reticent means reluctant or unwilling to speak. So it's not only the wrong word, it's kind of a redundancy or a pleonasm on top of that. And that's in How to Tell Fake from Destiny.
I just looked it up. Yes, it is there indeed. Let's take another call here from, this is Laura in Klamath Falls. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Charles Harrington Elster, the author of How to Tell Fate from Destiny.
Hi, I am really happy you're talking about this. I would love to have all the broadcasters in the world and the weather forecasters especially stop saying in the way of, nothing in the way of precipitation when they're using it for the opposite meaning. So in the way of means blocking, but they use it, well, we don't see any precipitation coming. So I would really love for that to just disappear. What do you think?
All right. Thanks for that, Laura.
Well, maybe it should disappear simply because it's a bit ambiguous and perhaps a bit too casual or colloquial, because that's actually not wrong. That's another way of using in the way of, meaning in the manner of or style of. But when you do that, and it's also easy to misconstrue it as getting in the way of obstructing. So it's always a good idea to choose the words that will not be ambiguous, the phrasing that will not invite another interpretation. What I really would like to see change with people who forecast or tell you about the weather is the pronunciation of temperature.
Oh, is
you hear how many syllables I've given it? Temperature. It's not temperature.
Right. I have noticed that a lot, too. Yeah. And, well, yeah, we have pictures and pictures in our day, too. But that's getting back to pronunciations. There is another call here from Karen and Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, I had two things. One is nauseous and nauseated. It drives me crazy. And the
why?
Other one,
can you say why? I'm sorry to interrupt, but...
Well, because a person is nauseated. They're not nauseous. I mean, if they're nauseous, then that's what I think they... You know, I could say they were nauseous, but they should say they're nauseated.
Yeah, if someone is nauseous, then that makes you nauseated.
Yeah.
Because nauseous traditionally means offensive or disgusting. In other words, I'm nauseated, made sick by that nauseous cigar smoke.
It just grates on my nerves when they say I'm nauseous. I'm going, yes, you are. But
this falls in that category, you know, I was speaking of earlier about when enough of us are wrong, we're right. I'm not sure we're going to win this one, but thank you for holding, you know, holding the line, because as W.H. Auden wrote in his great poem, September 1st, 1939, in the final stanza, defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. Yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. So thank you for being one of the just exchanging your messages.
Karen, you had one other thing you wanted to bring up.
I went to a lecture that was done by an Australian, and she kept saying there were a bunch of words that I had to kind of have to sit and process what she was saying. But the one that stands out in my mind was skeletal instead of skeletal.
Really? Okay, that's interesting. Thanks so much for calling, Karen. Good to hear from you. Skeletal instead of skeletal. Have you ever heard that even as
no,
a regionalism?
No, I haven't, and this is how I collect material for my work. And thank you for sharing that. I will check it out. In fact, I will if I can find anything worthwhile on it, I'll post something on the comments page of my website, charlesharringtonelster.com, and try to answer that question. If you don't see anything there by tomorrow, it means I couldn't find any good information on it, but thanks for the suggestion.
Yes, indeed. Thank you for that, Karen. I want to add, there's a final one here. It'll probably be the final one because we're almost out of time, but you have core and corpse, so C-O-R-P-S and C-O-R-P-S-E, and I'd like to throw in there the corp, too, because you have all these companies that are ending their names with corp, like Pacific Corp, and I notice that people call that constantly Pacific Core.
Oh, that's true. You know, thank you for pointing that out. I hadn't really registered that. Very interesting. That's obviously a shortening of corporation when they shorten it to corp at the end of that name, you know, Citicorp or whatever, which was your example?
Yes. Yeah, Pacific
Again,
Corp, yeah.
Pacific Corp, yeah. And they say core, right?
Often, yes.
Because in their mind, they're thinking C-O-R-P-S, like a group, a corps of soldiers or whatever. That must be why. That's my speculation.
Well, I would think so.
And maybe because ending it with a P sound doesn't sound as nice as just ending it with the R sound.
That's a pretty hard stop, yeah.
Maybe they're Frenchifying it. I don't know.
Okay, we got time for one more then, which is one of my favorites, imply and infer. This is really who's doing the action, right?
It is. As Theodore Bernstein said, great usage commentator, managing editor for the New York Times for many years, mid-20th century, in his book, The Careful Writer, he liked to explain this by saying the implier is the pitcher and the inferer is the catcher. So, you know, when you imply, you are sending out a suggestion. You're making a suggestion. When you infer, you're taking that information and coming to a conclusion or analyzing it in some way. So you can't infer something to somebody else. You have to imply it, and then the person receiving the information has to interpret it and infer it.
One of many solid bits of distinctions in the book, How to Tell Fate from Destiny and Other Skillful Word Distinctions, the work of Charles Harrington Elster, his dozenth book. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.